This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Every cartoon published in The New Yorker in its nearly 80-year history, that's 68,647 cartoons, is included in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker. It's a book and two CDs. On today's edition, we're listening back to interviews with New Yorker cartoonists. Ross Chast has published in the magazine since 1978. In the current edition of The New Yorker, her cartoon features a young man in a sweater sitting on the sidewalk behind a table with pamphlets and a donation box. The sign on the table reads, "Jews for Jesus," and also for pissing off one's parents, even if they weren't religious, in a way that the Hare Krishnas can't even begin to imagine. I spoke with Ross Chast in 1987 after the publication of her cartoon collection Mondo Boxo. It included her cartoons Camp Mandatory, where you'll have lots of fun or else. And she described The Perfect Family. They don't use very much salt, but when they do, they use sea salt. Please take a good look at the label, or else you'll probably get the wrong brand.
I guess they're just sort of this sort of perfect, obnoxious little family that you read about a lot in magazines and newspapers, and they're always doing everything sort of right, and they eat right, and they keep fit, and they like themselves a whole lot. And they're very clever, and I'm very happy for them, really.
Are you really? You resent them.
I don't know if I really resent them. I think they're kind of funny.
Did you ever want to be perfect yourself like that?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, especially when you read about these, oh, I don't know, I can't remember her name. She's some hostess and she has some book out, and I saw her on TV and she was so funny. She was just talking about setting a table for a company, and she just went on and on and on about the placemats and the napkins and the fork and the knife and the spoon and this glass and that glass, and everything was very clever, and you know, it was like cauliflower centerpieces, and it just was sort of funny.
You have one cartoon called Poets on Strike, about the great poetry strike of 1989, in which they brought in scabs, but the scabs only wrote things like roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is white. And after 6.5 months, an agreement was reached, and even the most depressed poet was happy, sort of. That cartoon made me think of what an unusual job you have. Kind of like the poets going on strike. Poets don't go on strike. Nobody notices poets. And cartoonists, I mean, you're at home all day. Most likely, trying to come up with ideas. Is that a difficult and lonely life?
There are times when it's harder than others. When it's going well, it seems like the easiest job in the world. And when it's not, then it's, I wouldn't say, you know, necessarily the hardest job in the world, but then it's just harder.
Are there things that come your way that you save because you know that there will eventually be a good idea for a cartoon?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't even know if I think that directly. I do save things here and there that may never find their way into a cartoon, but that I kind of like.
Such as?
Recently I got something. I guess it's a company called the Wisconsin Cheese Man, and it's these huge. Well, I guess since it's the Christmas season and all that, it's these huge crates of arrangements of cheeses and summer sausages and petits fours and weird sauces, and it's all arranged so there's like a big cheese in the center, and it's like a mandala. But of
I know exactly what you mean. And is there a little like green, the equivalent of confetti, you know, around it to make it look
like
festive,
like a lawn kind of,
exactly.
Or something?
So this is going to be used as a cartoon, do you think?
Oh, I doubt it. Maybe in a cartoon about something else. Completely, that might have a little tiny, you know, cameo role or something.
But that's one of the things I really love about your cartoons. Everything really rings true. There's all these little details about life. Like when you draw that cartoon and there's a little image in passing with this cheese box, I'm going to recognize it because I've seen these cheese boxes. It's those details, I think, that, among other things, that really make your cartoons so special.
Oh, well, thank you.
What else are you saving now?
Oh, let me see. Ugh, I have all kinds of ridiculous things. How to keep hamster manuals, and what do I have? I have a book called Chickens in Your Backyard. I don't know whether these will ever show up in cartoons. They're just things that I collect that I think are funny, and, you know, they might not. I don't know.
You know, when I first started seeing your cartoons, and I saw that they were by R. Chast, I said to myself, is it a man or a woman? Did people ever think you were a man before you became known as Roz Chast?
Yes, I still occasionally get letters, believe it or not, to Mr. Roz Chast. Which is, you know, really insisting on, you know, something. But I just sort of stuck with it. Well, I did go through a tiny phase for a few weeks, I think it lasted, of signing my name Roz Chast, because an editor, a woman editor, had said to me, well, you're a woman cartoonist, and you should let people know you're a woman. And, you know, I mean, that it may be right, but I felt funny. I felt every time I signed it, it's like, oh, well, now she likes me more because I'm signing my name like this. I guess now I'm better in her book. And I felt stupid doing it. I just, you know, said, well, this is not how I really sign my name. This is, I sign it R. Chast. That's how I sign it.
But that's interesting. So you never decided to sign it R. Chast to keep your sexual...
No, no, that's...
Your gender unknown.
No, not at all. I mean, obviously, if I wanted to do that, in the contents in the New Yorker, when they list the cartoons, I would have had them print R. Chast there, but, you know.
Let me just ask you one last question. Did you, when you started cartooning, did you approach it with the idea of wanting to do it differently than it had been done before?
No, this is not really. This is just really the way I draw. And when I tried to do it the same as other people, I knew that that didn't work at all. That was a disaster. I guess some people, when they get out of college, they really are very much in a lather about what they're going to do next. But, I mean, at the time that I started, I just knew that this is really what I like to do.
Roz Chast recorded in 1987. In 1986, I spoke with Gayon Wilson, whose work is also included in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. Many of his cartoons have a macabre and ghoulish sensibility, inspired by horror movies and science fiction. He was also influenced by the late New Yorker cartoonist Charles Adams. I asked Wilson to describe some of his early cartoons.
There's this fellow, and he's in a cannibal pot. He's being cooked. And he has an evil look on his face, and he has a bottle of poison, and he's pouring the poison in the water he's being cooked in, and that was one. And then, let me see, there was one where there's this little kid, and he's with his father, and they're in a snowstorm, and there's this dead bird on a snowbank with his feet in the air, and the little kid's pointing at it, and he says, look, Daddy, the first robin, that kind of stuff. It was very much in keeping with what I do today.
Another theme that recurs in your work, and there's a wonderful chapter on it in your new book, is childhood fears, and especially some of the really irrational ones that we all have. I'd like to go over some of those with you and see if you had them and where you think they came from. The toilet monster is really one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Could you explain the toilet monster?
The toilet monster is... if in the middle of the night you have to go to the bathroom, you have to be very careful because there is this thing who lives down in the works underneath there. All plumbing is a source of great peril and danger because it goes from the known world into the unknown depths there, and that's why we have all these things about. Snakes coming into the bathtub via the drain, and we know, of course, about the crocodiles and the sewers and all that sort of stuff. But there's also this thing, which is somehow associated with a toilet. It's down there. And at night, if you flush the toilet, you're liable to waken it, and it may come up and get you. So you have to flush it and get the hell out very quickly.
Were you really worried about that?
I thank God I wasn't. This was something that I heard from somebody else. But a lot of the other ones.
Making a face. What's going to happen if you make a face?
Making a face. If you make a face and somebody startles you, like you get slapped in the back, or there's an explosion or backfire, something like that. You've got to watch out because it might freeze on your face forever. So you'll have for the rest of your life. And then there's a lot of stuff happens is because parents don't understand and make you do things that are obvious, they're fatal. I mean, like eating cherries with milk. Every kid knows eating cherries with milk or something else. It depends on the region and so on. There are various combinations of food which are fatal. And parents don't understand that. And they make the kid do it anyhow. And the kid does it because he's a good kid. And it kills them. And the parents feel very bad because they've done it. But that's life. That's the way it goes. That's part of growing up. And there's also stuff like trying to cope with the mysterious areas, like if something falls down into a drain or something, like a ball or a dime rolls down, don't reach into the thing with your bare hands because something may get it, you know, your fingers or the whole hand and pull you in or something like that. There's no safety if you're a kid anywhere at all.
Did you draw little monsters in the margins of your notebook?
I did indeed. And I had a strange experience in that I went through some stuff that from the family. My parents are dead, and there was a bunch of stuff there. And I there's one box which had these drawings I'd done as a little teeny bitsy kid. And they were pre-literate. You know, I was really a little itsy bitsy. And they're monsters, you know. They're all kinds of stuff like that. And there's one, I remember one has in a mother's loving hand. It says, "A strange monster come to kill us all." And so, I was doing that kind of junk way back then.
Cartoonist Gayon Wilson recorded in 1986. His work is represented in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. Today we're hearing from some of the cartoonists featured in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. Bruce Eric Kaplan signs his cartoons with his initials, B.E.K. His work has been featured in the New Yorker for over 10 years. Kaplan has also written for the TV shows Sybil, Seinfeld, and 6 Feet Under, where he's now an executive producer. I spoke with him earlier this year after the publication of his book, This is a Bad Time. It collects his cartoons from The New Yorker and other publications, including The Boston Globe and LA Weekly. I asked Kaplan to describe one of the cartoons in his book.
This is a chicken talking to a bird in a farm set, in a barn-like setting, and the chicken saying, "Sometimes I get so bored with myself, I can barely make it to doodle-doo."
No, where did that come? What made you think about that?
Oh, come on, please! Aren't you? Don't you get? You can't make it to doodle do some mornings.
But I wouldn't have thought of the chicken. I just would have thought about myself.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like a whole language, the world of cartoons. I mean, that there's images, classic ones like the people crawling in the desert or the people on the deserted island. But you know, there's a whole. Is it lexicon? Is that using the word correctly?
Sure.
Of just images and worlds that you can sort of take your thoughts and plug them into. Like, a farm setting is a wonderful one, I think. I love farms. I love, not that I've ever been to one, but I love drawing them.
You mentioned desert. You have a great one of two people crawling across the desert.
Right.
Can you describe it?
Sure. It's a woman and man crawling in a desert, looking obviously starving and thirsty, and the woman turns to the man and says, "This isn't really about water, it's about what's going on between us," you know, as if they've been arguing.
Yeah. Now, how did you start drawing cartoons? What made you think, this is something I can do?
I just always drew little people. Like, you know, when I was talking on the phone or when I was drawing, I mean, when I was watching TV, I would always draw little people, little men and little women, you know, going about their business. I actually think some holding cocktail glasses the way that I still do for New Yorker cartoons. I mean, I always loved the New Yorker. I was very passionate about Charles Adams. I was definitely, like, very Charles Adams focused as a child and would, you know, take his stuff out of the library constantly. You know, all the time. I just said this the other day. So when I was taking out his books, like, all the time from the library, like, you know, every 2 weeks. I don't know why someone just didn't give me one, but they didn't.
What came first, writing for television or cartooning?
They actually came at the same time. What happened was I had been trying to write for television and not succeeding at it, and I thought, like, oh, I don't remember how it came to me, but I thought, like, I could be a New Yorker cartoonist. I mean, one day it was just like, yes, that I could do. You know, I'm not succeeding at this other thing, but this one I can do. So I, like, you know, read in the library, like, I got a book out, How to Be a Cartoonist, and I said there was an art meeting once a week, and I started submitting, you know, I did 10 drawings and sent them off with a self-addressed envelope, like the book in the library told me to do, and I was, you know, of course, like everything I did at the time, I was sure they were going to buy all 10 drawings, and I just sat there in my apartment, and I, you know, drew my next group so I wouldn't miss next week's meeting, and sent that off, and then this my first envelope came back with a rejection letter, and I was so shocked. I couldn't believe it. It was this form rejection letter. I thought, like, you know, I'd sent them these brilliant things, I thought. And so I just, you know, assumed they had made a mistake on some level and that they were going to buy some of the second group. So I started working on my third group. And then, you know, of course, needless to say, I got my envelope back, the second group. And anyhow, it was a compulsion by this time, and I actually spent a few years sending, you know, 10, 15, 20 cartoons every week. I never missed an art meeting for a few years, and so now I was also concurrently trying to be a sitcom writer and failing at both. So then, a few years into it, my friend Kenny had hired me for the Emmy Awards, and I came back from work one day, and instead of my self-addressed envelope, there was a FedEx from the New Yorker, and I just cried. I mean, because it was, I knew something was happening, obviously, and I opened it up, and it was an acceptance letter, you know, and it was such a big deal. It was just like, I would get these little tiny, they're not even 8.5 by 11, they're like note card rejection letters that are no signature. It was like sending these off into a void. So the idea that finally someone, you know, had read them. I mean, I would write cover letters that said, like, cursing at them, saying, here are, you know, 10 bleeping cartoons that any other bleeping magazine would publish except for you, because I figured it didn't feel like anyone was actually reading these cartoons. It just felt like they would open them up and put them in my self-addressed envelope and send them back to me. When I got the FedEx, the first line was, I know you think we haven't been reading your stuff. But we have, and here are these cartoons. We'd like you to draw, you know, revise them. And then that led to a new world of horror, because revising, I thought I was drawing these perfect things. I had no idea I was supposed to be revising these images.
What kind of revisions did they ask for?
Oh, God, it's embarrassing now, but I mean, he said, you know, I had no idea. I really did, you know, this is how I was in my 20s. I thought, like, oh, these are perfect. So I called him up. It was Lee Lorenz, the art editor at the time. And I said, like, hi, I'm Bruce Kaplan. I'm excited to do these revisions, but what should I change? And he said, like, well, you see the table in that picture? It doesn't look like a table. You know, a table should have four legs. It was like that type of thing. So he would tell me, you know, things in my drawings that just really weren't cutting it.
Here's a cartoon that I figure relates to writing in some way. Someone's driving in a car along a big deserted strip of highway and passes a billboard, and the billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles. And I don't know, to me that's not only about just kind of having to be alone for a long time on a deserted highway or alone any place like that. I just have a feeling, too, that for you as a writer, maybe it feels that way sometimes, that you have a dry spell and like
it's never not a dry spell for me. I'm one of those writers who, you know, moans in agony, or cartoonists constantly, you know, why are there no good ideas? You know, I despise myself. It's always the same thought going on in my head.
So what do you do to kind of break the dry spell when you're feeling that way? Sit there and hope for the best.
sometimes it helps to go through the negative emotions in terms of, like, to do a drawing about hating oneself or about, you know, not having any ideas. And maybe that drawing will be great or not, but then it'll be exercised a little bit, and then you'll think about something else that's on your mind, and that will, you know, you'll move forward. I mean, gradually, it's always like a trick to just lose yourself in the process, and if you have faith, then you can. That's my opinion.
Bruce Eric Kaplan is a New Yorker cartoonist whose work is in the new book, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. He's also an executive producer of 6 Feet Under. This is Fresh Air.